Россия собирала компромат на Дональда Трампа.
Информацию о пятилетних связях Дональда Трампа с Россией.
О финансах и личной жизни Трампа, которые могут быть...
О встречах Трампа с проститутками.
Трамп приезжал в Россию 5 раз.
Ложной новостью или попросту фейком.
Videotapes of politicians caught in salacious acts, dossiers of bribes and shady business deals, tools of blackmail, instruments of control. The dark art of honey traps and money traps has long been a key weapon in the Kremlin arsenal. They've been used to discredit troublesome politicians at home and to recruit and develop networks of influence abroad. And now they're being updated for the digital age. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the podcast, Don.
Hi, Brian. Good to be back.
Good to have you. And joining us from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the widely acclaimed book Nothing is True and Everything is Possible Inside the Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Welcome back, Peter. Great to see you.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Thanks for coming. So the reason we're discussing this issue today is pretty obvious. The dossier that was released this week, compiled by a retired MI6 agent, alleging that the Kremlin had gathered compromising material on Donald Trump that could be later used to blackmail the U.S. president-elect. And we should stress at the very outset that these allegations are unsubstantiated. They're not coming from any Western intelligence service, but they are out there. So without getting into any salty details, since this is a family podcast, I wanted to get your opinion, Don, as a foreign policy professional, what your reaction to this dossier was. My regular co-host, Mark Galeotti, is on the record as being very skeptical. Wired had an excellent piece this week, citing numerous intelligence professionals, arguing that we should take the dossier, quote, seriously, but not literally. In other words, we should take these allegations seriously, but approach them with some caution. What was, just to get this out of the way at the outset, Don, what was your reaction when you read this dossier?
Well, my reaction actually was not as a Russia watcher or a former diplomat. My reaction as a former journalist editor, I thought it was garbage. And my first question was, what is the source? Mm-hmm. And clearly, this stuff would never be run on RFE as a real story. And that's the problem. And so you don't have to react even as a Russia watcher. You just have to react as someone who wants real information factually sourced. And that's not here.
Well, no media organization really ran it except BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed published the dossier in its entirety. No other media organizations really got into the details. CNN reported that both Donald Trump and Barack Obama were briefed about its existence. It turns out it had been passed, I guess, to the FBI from John McCain. It was originally Oppo Research, conducted during the Republican primary, that later found its way into the Clinton campaign, found its way eventually into John McCain's hands, and eventually got to the FBI and was in the FBI's hands. The FBI was taking it seriously enough to investigate it. The document was circulating around Washington for quite some time.
Last night, Brian said that they had it last summer.
Yeah.
And Fox surprisingly claimed journalistic ethics, saying they didn't run it because it was garbage. And that was the big Riley line last night.
Yeah, no, I know several journalists from big U.S. publications were trying to confirm unsuccessfully the details of this report. Peter, what were your thoughts upon reading this, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I can add to Don's in insightful evaluation is something that the Newsweek journalist Owen Matthews pointed out. He said that, in a way, because the dossier was feeding into high-level intelligence reports to the president, then maybe there is some sort of need for the public to see it in order to see that what the president is looking at is you know, unverifiable, you know, slightly fantastical stuff. So in that way, there is a public service, and it's one of this public service that helps Trump, essentially, in that it shows just how, oddly unsubstantiated the material against him is.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we do know is that, again, we don't know if any of this is true. A lot of doubts have been raised about it. But what we do know is that the U.S. intelligence community is taking it seriously enough to brief both the president and the president-elect on its existence. We know this was opposition research conducted during the Republican primary that eventually got its it found its way into the hands of the FBI, according to media reports passed by John McCain. But at this point, we just don't know. But what we do know is that this tactic of using both the honey traps and the money traps that have been included in this dossier, because this wasn't just about the salacious allegations of meetings with prostitutes, but also about business deals as well. What we do know is that the Kremlin uses both of these tactics. This is one of the oldest tricks in the book. It's called kompromat in Russian. It's been used against opposition figures at home. It's been used against officials who've fallen out of favor. It's been used against foreign diplomats. And it's even been used against foreign officials in the past in Europe. Don, Russia's been doing this for decades, going back to the Cold War. How has this practice changed over time? How do you see it changing over time?
They have been doing it for decades. And I guess what I would say is answer to your question is that the technology of it makes it much more universally disseminable, if that's a word. The technology, the social media and everything else allows what you're doing to get much more widespread attention. Now, whether it's effective or not is another question. And I think the other factor I would put in my answer to you is that what's unique here is that Putin is using it as a tool of foreign policy. And I think that overtly was not the case before. This is new. This is something. This is taking the tools of governance, or ruling, and now using them in foreign policy. We saw that in Ukraine. We've seen other examples as well. I think that is relatively new, at least as an overt instrument of influence.
Although they did do this kind of thing during the Cold War abroad as well, no?
They did it, but I think in a much more targeted way. The public stuff, Voice of Russia or whatever it might be, was not very credible even at home or abroad. But I think what's different is the extent to which it's spread, and getting into a point that Peter has written about, the extent to which with the West's own sort of crisis of values and uncertainty about truth makes this a much more fertile ground to spread these seeds. You don't know if Trump, this is stuff is true or not. You don't know where it came from. But a lot of people say, well, yeah, we sort of figured that on whatever the story might be, not just this. And I think that's a major difference. And people, those of us who study information warfare, talk a lot about this value issue. Political scientists use the term resilience. We're much less resilient now than we were then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And actually, there was an interesting piece this morning in The Guardian arguing that the release of this dossier actually helps Putin. It's a win for Putin,
yes,
because
yes.
It furthers the doubt and furthers the divisions within inside the United States. Mark Galeotti made a similar point in a piece immediately after the dossier came out. And another, I mean, example of how this has been updated to the digital age, you've seen in domestic politics when these kinds of things have been released to expose figures who have been caught in so-called honey traps, like opposition leader Ilya Yashin, the anti-Kremlin comedian Viktor Shandorovich, the former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov turned opposition figure. They've been released on websites like Life News, which is a very slick so-called news site, which is connected to the Russian security services. Peter, what are your thoughts on how this has been, how this old Kremlin tactic has been kind of updated for the digital age?
Yeah, and it kind of, it makes me also think of stuff which is not necessarily within the sphere of politics, which is the sphere of entertainment. So I'm immediately thinking of the Paris Hilton sex tapes and the Jennifer Lawrence, raid on her iCloud or whatever it was, which showed all her nude pictures. It seems to be happening. It seems to be a thing in the internet. It's quite transformative that way because it's so easy to hack and leak and all these things. So suddenly you have these sort of nudie sex videos coming out about politicians or pop stars. And I do wonder whether it's always going to be very unpleasant for the victim, especially, you know, for their personal relationships, if they were caught being unfaithful or something. But I wonder whether, as an audience, we'll become desensitized after a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with the Trump, especially with Trump, it kind of fits into his... into the larger narrative around him, and not one that has damaged him in any way.
Don, please.
Peter correctly raises the question about the U.S. voters' perception of him, their own leaders. And, you know, taboos breaking. Well, there was once a taboo against having a divorced president. Now we're here. And a lot of Bible Belt, Christian voters really disregarded all these colorful activities of Trump during the campaign for reasons having to do with the choice that they made about what would advance their interests. So Peter's correct. Are we going to become desensitized to this? Does it not matter anymore that Ronald Reagan was the first divorced president? Things like that. We're looking at the presidency much differently now than we used to, and that may be more like the Russians see their leaders, where they tend to keep a stronger wall between public and private. And a lot of this stuff, whether it's Skuratov or Kasyanov, I don't really know what effect it has at all.
Mm-hmm. But in this sense, it does play into the Kremlin's desire to basically bring us down to their level in a lot of ways.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And just to cause chaos.
Now, we're not just talking about the salacious stuff here, the honey traps. We're also talking about money traps. These two things are both part. I see them as two sides of the same coin that the Kremlin uses. The trick is to first you corrupt and then you control. This is possible to do with a honey trap, but it's also possible to do with what I would call a money trap, Don. No, I mean, basically ensnaring either somebody domestically or abroad in a shady business deal. And then you have something to hang over them.
You certainly do. This could be maybe Berlusconi. This could be maybe somebody else. And I think that is how the Kremlin seems to approach these things. But again, I question the degree to which they can micromanage to the extent that people say. And second, I question the extent to which every power center in the Kremlin is absolutely subordinate to Putin on this kind of thing and not playing their own game. So whether it's a rivalry between services or just different people out there playing their own games, I think I do have a question about that. If you go back to the Khodorkovsky case, for example, yes, you had the initial arrest and the trial, but everybody else started acting, pursuing their own agendas. And it happens again and again. It's happened with the recent turmoil in the Kremlin power ministries as well. And then the murder of Nemtsov, people are playing their own games within the general rubric of Kremlin attempts to control situations. And I just doubt that they're successful often, or I think sometimes, and that there are unintended consequences of this. And one of the unintended consequences of doing this kind of thing is that now it's going to be harder for Moscow and Washington to improve relations, because the opponents which Trump already faced in Congress about his Russia views now are going to be emboldened and empowered, and that's going to cause problems ultimately for Moscow too.
Yeah, no, there was an interesting piece this morning by Reuters on this, that basically they're not in such a celebratory mood in Moscow right now, because it's going to be more difficult. So they're for Trump to reset relations with Russia, if you will, given everything that's come out, whether or not it's true. And that's,
I was talking to a Russian, let's call him opposition person this week, who said, you know, Hillary was not as tough on Russia for much of her tenure either. And to some extent, this is just payback to the U.S. That's all it is. Nothing more sophisticated than that. Mm.
Peter, anything to add there?
Yeah, that'll be very, I think there's just two paths which are possible. In one way, what we're seeing is Trump voters becoming more pro-Russian, because the more you attack Trump with Russia, the more natural reaction of his voters is to become more pro-Russian. You know, they're going to stand by their guy. And you see these really, I think, in the long term, very scary statistics about Republican voters, you know, becoming more and more pro-Putin. So that's the one thing. And in a way, you know, what we should we, you know, what people who believe in kind of, or shall we say, are hawkish about Russia, what they should really be aiming for is trying to split Putin and Trump. I thought it was a very good letter by Eastern European sort of politicians saying, you know, Mr. Trump, you know, Mr. Putin is not actually your friend. And I actually think that's probably the wisest kind of strategic narrative to pursue, to point out to Trump that he's wrong in his admiration of Putin. And I always fear that the more he's attacked with Putin, he'll actually end up, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not the day after, but on a very fundamental level, you know, growing closer to him.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's a good way to segue into the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the show and the spectacle of compromat revelations on Kremlin-controlled media. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the widely acclaimed book Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, Inside the Surreal Heart of the New Russia. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Человек, похожий на генерального прокурора.
Генеральный прокурор Скуратов получал в подарок женщин на сумму от одной.
На месте Скуратова мог быть любой чиновник.
Сокового ранга, мелкого ранга.
Оставшись в истории человеком, похожим на генерального прокурора.
Who can forget человек, который похожий на Скуратов, or the person who resembles Скуратов? It was all the rage in Moscow back in 1999. Скуратов, then Russia's prosecutor general, launched an investigation into top Kremlin officials. Russian television showed what it called, quote, a man resembling Скуратов frolicking with two prostitutes. The director of the FSB then went on television to confirm that the man was, in fact, Skuratov. And Skuratov was soon out of a job. And, oh, by the way, the director of the FSB at that time was none other than Vladimir Putin. It was Russia's most salacious post-Soviet tabloid sensation, and the show has gone on since. In the years since, opposition leader Ilya Yashin, anti-Kremlin comedian Viktor Shandarovich, former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov, and many others have been compromised with sex tapes that have appeared online. Peter, you've worked in Russian television. What can you say about the spectacle of all this in Russia?
I actually wonder to what extent it's different to any other kind of political attacks. Internal ones. They're in any country. I mean, in Britain, we have nonstop stuff in our tabloids about various public figures being caught with prostitutes and photographs.
Right, but it's not directed from number 10.
Right, I see what you mean. So it's not in a way. It feels kind of. It always feels a little bit familiar. It just seems. I don't know. I mean, sexual entrapment seems to me a very common way of attacking your enemies. I mean, it sounds very sort of like, U.S. 1960s as well, with sort of the mafia. I don't know. I don't know how different it is from the Western spectacle. I mean, what was already interesting about the late 1990s TV spectacle in Russia is that, to what extent it looked to visually sort of, and in terms of a tone, imitate Western TV. That's what sort of was special about sort of that period.
Well, I would say what's different, though, is that in the West, yes, you do have this same kind of spectacle playing itself out in the British tabloids, for example. But in Russia, a lot of it is, if not directed centrally from the Kremlin, by or by in the 90s was more the case from different Kremlin factions. It seems to me the Kremlin today is killing two birds with one stone here. They're discrediting its opponents, and on one hand, and entertaining the public with bread and circuses on the other. No, what do you think about that, Don? Are they kind of?
I very much agree. If you look at the Russian coverage of this just in the past week, they're crowing about how the preoccupation in Washington with Russia, and as we always say Washington generally doesn't think much about Russia, and the reverse is absolutely not true. And so I think this very much is a circus to get Putin's base, as they would say, to see what a tough guy he is and how he's staring down and pushing back on the great enemy.
And what about how when this plays out domestically? I mean, when they compromise a figure like Yashin, and you know, put the stuff out there online, or when you discredited official is caught in a corruption scandal, and you get those videos with the stacks of money and everything, and the opulent apartments being searched by masked men, and this is all shown on primetime television. It's part of it has this feel of kind of a Western cop show. Right. And so it's entertainment. But the other part of it is there is a clear political goal here. No, I mean, so they're marrying these two things together in the domestic context as well as in the foreign context.
Yes. Yes. There are also two. If that's for me, there are also two audiences here. One is the general society, which whether in Ukraine or elsewhere, wants to see a show.
Right.
A television show. But there's also the sphere of elite politics, and this is a way for Putin to keep people off balance. If you don't know when they're going to do a Khodorkovsky on you or whoever you want, then you're a lot more susceptible to manipulation by Vlast.
Mm. Peter, any thoughts there?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think Don put that very, very well. I think you've pinpointed the case that this mixture of sort of like tabloid plus keeping the sort of sense of looming threat over people. The Chinese have a word for it that's called the boa constrictor in the chandelier. You kind of just know that the threat is hanging above you and it could strike at any moment. Mm-hmm. And you just keeps you on your toes.
No, I mean, officially, the Russian regime is very Puritan right now, yeah. Right? And I think there's an interesting contrast here because you have a very Puritan regime that is using these very tabloidy, salacious tactics as both a means of entertaining the public and controlling the elite. What about that, Peter?
Oh, but it's not puritanical. That's just part of the show. You put some, you know, you have a TV show. You have a crazy priest and a transvestite, and it's the puritanical thing is the Puritans versus the hedonists is just a show that the Russian regime puts on to distract from like corruption. So it's not. I mean, it doesn't enact any of its puritanical stuff. There's still, despite all its sort of like, you know, its insignia and its aura being used, the Orthodox Church still has so little influence over, firstly, education in the country, which is where that will be practiced. That's where sort of moral norms will be enforced. And certainly, you know, we've seen no shift in stuff like, you know, divorce or children out of wedlock. I don't know if there are official statistics about the use of prostitutes, but I think that remains almost normalized in large parts of Russian society.
John, would you agree with that? Because I do see, I see a regime that is presenting at least a public face. It may be a show, as Peter says, to mask corruption. But I see a regime that's moved increasingly in a conservative Orthodox Christian direction at a time when this regime is increasingly using these salacious tactics to discredit opponents or compromise and recruit, you know, agents of influence, and using the spectacle to entertain the public.
You are both my friends, so I don't think you're contradicting each other. I think the regime is not sincere about it, but I think they use it as a tool of governance and manipulation, and that's a big difference. As long as a lot of Russians, I won't give a number, as long as a lot of Russians think that Putin stands against gays, that's all that matters, even if maybe people in the ruling elite are gay. I think that it's a tool of governance. It's not sincere, and that's why you see Putin at the Orthodox services for Christmas on TV, for example. To me, that's a political statement. It's not a reflection of inner life, as the Jesuits might say. Right. Can I make another point though on this? The issue of desensitization of a society is extremely interesting, and it's a problem for Putin in that at some point you may run out of things that upset or mobilize the population. And It was the fascists in Kiev 2 years ago, and then it was the Syria war, and it was the U.S., the enemy. We go from obsession to obsession, and at some point, maybe the Russian people just get sort of indifferent to all of it. I don't know. But I find the rolling obsession over the last several years a very interesting an interesting phenomenon politically.
Well, no, I've seen it compared to a drug addiction almost. And yeah, where you just the drugs the dosage has to get higher and higher and higher in order for it to keep working.
Something else and that kind of thing.
Peter, you in your experience working in Russian television, can you offer any insights in this how what kind of thought goes into the preparation of this spectacle?
It seems quite a straightforward one. I don't know how much you need. You've got the raw material, you put it on. It seems a pretty simple one, and a very classic one. I don't know. It doesn't seem very original. It all seems very sort of tabloid and simple. You know, you have, have juicy sex tape, put it on. It doesn't seem very complicated.
Right.
I don't think there's much subtlety that you need there.
Right. Now, Don, you and I were both in Moscow when the Skuratov story broke. At the time, it was shocking that they were doing this. I mean, it was mind blowing. And the Sunday talk shows, which in the past were kind of wonk fests, suddenly turned into something entirely different. Did you ever dream at that time that we'd get to this point?
No. Of course,
that would be such a harbinger. I mean,
we used to use Wang floppy disks in the embassy till the mid 90s. So you had no idea any of this would be very popular.
Yeah, no, but I mean, but to that scandal that took place in 99 would be such a harbinger of things to come in the future. I mean, kompromat had always been used, but it was always a leak to this newspaper or that newspaper that this politician or that politician took a bribe, and it was all part of clan warfare. And the Skuratov thing was also part of clan warfare. But I think one thing that changed with the Skuratov thing is you really saw the Kremlin close ranks, because Skuratov was tied into this challenge that was coming against the Kremlin from the mayor of Moscow, Yuri Lushkov, Yevgeny Primakov, the former prime minister, and the Kremlin felt itself really threatened. And you saw a real closing of ranks in this all-out effort to discredit Skuratov, who is aligned with that faction that was challenging the Kremlin. And I thought that was a precursor in a lot of ways to the things we're seeing now in terms of the Kremlin using this tactic of again, the honey trap or the money trap to either whatever, discredit a domestic opponent or recruit a foreign agent of influence. It was almost a turning point, no?
Yeah, I agree. My question, I guess, would be about Kasyanov.
Uh-huh.
Did that hurt his, which is much more recent? Because I agree with the attorney. Has that hurt his political career? It's hard from the outside to judge. It wasn't much of a political career to begin with.
It wasn't much of a political career to begin with. I think it did what it intended to do at the time, and that was to basically to divide the opposition.
I think it was
successful in that. I think the operations against people like Yashin and Shenderovich were much less successful, to be honest. I mean, they were embarrassing to be sure, but I don't think they hurt any of those people. Kasyanov, in this case, he was not in a great position to begin with. The scandal that came out of that was not so much the salacious aspect, but what Kasyanov was saying about other members of the opposition.
Yeah.
And of course, you remember the audio recordings that were released of Boris Nemtsov back in 2011, 2012, of him making disparaging comments about other members of the opposition and using foul language, which would come as a shock to nobody.
You just made an important point that I don't want us to gloss over, which you talked about Skuratov as being part of an inter-elite struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that this is different in that way, too. I don't think anybody would consider Kasyanov a part of the Kremlin elite.
No.
And that's a different dimension to what happened then at that turning point, as you correctly pointed out.
Yeah, no. And they were with Kasyanov, they were basically trying to split the opposition as best they could. Peter, any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
Well, I think we've been circling around a very important underlying theme, which is that this is taking part during a time when kind of the sort of political, I'm trying to find an elegant way of putting it, sort of like, you know, the dirty linen sexual scandal, and also the use of kind of like sexualized language has suddenly become much more normalized. I think it still is, actually, you know, can be tragic for people. I think for the people personally involved, it can still be devastating in many ways. But you're quite right. I mean, there's a greater shift towards all this kind of like stuff that was always considered private to be public, and also a change in the use of language. I mean, isn't there something much deeper going on culturally, firstly about norms, but also something, there's something, it's part of their rebellion. You know, they're breaking linguistic and behavioral norms in the same way they're breaking the establishment.
Don, last word to you.
I want to go back to Trump, which is to say, he's got a Russia problem that may get worse. And I would think that somebody around him is telling him that we got to close this dissonance among the many members of his team, which has gotten very public just in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
And I think he's got to respond to this in a way that pushes the country toward a coherent foreign policy to Russia. Mm-hmm. Because as of this moment, the Hill, even in the federal and in the executive branch, people are all over the place, and even in NATO, and upset or concerned that they don't know what's going to happen. And that's very troubling.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Vladimir Putin would like at
exactly.
this point.
Yes.
So, all right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us from London has been Peter Pomerantsev, author of the widely acclaimed book Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible, Inside the Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening conversation.
Brian, this is my husband.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.